Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we are getting an update on the $1.85 trillion climate change and social safety net bill. After months of negotiations, Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are still standing in the way. As we've been reporting for months, they have taken money from Big Pharma and Big Oil. Paid family leave, paid medical leave, and the federal government's ability to negotiate drug prices for those on Medicare have been removed from the bill. But Democratic Senators Bernie Sanders, Kristen Gillibrand, and others are working to restore those provisions. Here is Senator Bernie Sanders, who chairs the Budget Finance Committee, discussing drug prices on CNN over the weekend.
We are paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. The pharmaceutical industry has spent hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to make certain that Americans pay 10 times more for some drugs than the Canadians or the Mexicans do. That fight continues. And the fight to expand Medicare, look, poll after poll shows that the American people understand it is not acceptable that elderly people have teeth in their mouth that are rotting. They can't digest their food. They don't have the vision that they need in order to read a newspaper. So we are continuing that effort.
So
and
can I
it
just
pains me very much. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I just want to just make sure that I understand what you're saying. You're saying you're continuing that effort. You want to still add it before the House votes? You want to add it to the bill that the
Absolutely.
House...
Absolutely. Look, we're working, as everybody should know, we're on two separate bills. You got a bipartisan infrastructure bill, which will finally begin to address the reality that our roads and our bridges and our water systems are crumbling. That's one bill. But we want to move both bills in tandem. And the second bill, the bill that deals with the needs of the working class of this country in terms of childcare, in terms of pre-K, that deals with the existential threat of climate, that bill is still being worked on literally today. It will be worked on tomorrow. I believe we're making some progress in making it even stronger than it is.
If you don't succeed in that progress, will you support the framework as it currently stands, what the White House released at the end of the week?
Well, all I will tell you is we have a very, very strong bill. And it deals with the fact that we are going to start paying attention to the needs of working parents, continue that $300. We're going to build affordable housing. We're going to make sure that elderly people and people with disabilities can stay at home rather than be forced into a nursing home, et cetera. We're going to demand that the wealthiest people in this country start paying their fair share of taxes.
So that sounds like that's a yes. If you're not successful,
more,
you will support.
It's a very good bill. No, but I am... Right now, I can tell you, I have worked yesterday, we're working today, we're going to work tomorrow to strengthen that bill. It is outrageous that we continue to pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs.
I want to ask you about that.
And that one out of four Americans cannot afford the prescriptions that their doctors write. That is not acceptable.
That is Senator Bernie Sanders discussing drug prices and the overall social safety bill, the climate bill, on CNN over the weekend. Climate policies, universal pre-K, and expanding the child tax credit are still included, but there are a lot of moving parts to this bill still. Joining us now is David Sirota, founder of The Daily Poster. This is a reader-supported investigative journalism project that covers politics, business, and corporate power. David is a columnist at Jacobin Magazine and The Guardian, co-producer of the upcoming Netflix film Don't Look Up, and host of the new podcast Meltdown, which explores how the 2008 financial crisis happened, with a lot of information about what the Obama administration did and did not do. Hi, David. Thanks so much for your great work, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
I should also say happy birthday to you. Over the weekend, you were on CNN. You actually had 3 minutes to talk about the big money behind this bill, which is not really getting much attention at all.
Yeah, and it was interesting to be on CNN and be given a chance, even though it was brief, to discuss that. And the point I made, and I'll make here, is that a lot of the discussion about the reconciliation bill is a palace drama discussion about what one politician is saying and the other politician is saying, and this portrayal of supposedly vast ideological, principled ideological differences between the warring factions. And what's written out of the story is the fact that industries are bankrolling politicians, and the politicians that just so happen to be blocking what the public wants out of this bill, those politicians happen to be bankrolled in a very serious way by the industries that want those provisions blocked. You can see that most obviously on the prescription drug pricing issue. The Democrats have been campaigning on a promise to lower medicine prices in general and to allow Medicare to negotiate lower prices in specific. They've been campaigning on that for 15 plus years. And this was supposed to be in this legislation. And a handful of Democratic lawmakers have voted in the House to block it. In the Senate, Kyrsten Sinema has made all sorts of her office has leaked all sorts of comments saying that they might oppose it. And if you follow the money, you see that the pharmaceutical industry has suddenly been funneling an enormous amount of money to these specific lawmakers who are all of a sudden, Democratic lawmakers, who are all of a sudden saying that they oppose these provisions, which are wildly popular. They are considered, polls show they are the most supported policies in the entire set of proposals in the reconciliation bill. And now these proposals are being either watered down or potentially even cut out from the bill. And the story that hasn't been told largely in corporate media is that, you know, there's been all the, oh, why is Sinema opposing this? Or why is this Democrat opposing that? I can't figure it out. What is this mystery here? And the only reason it's a mystery is if you decide to avert your eyes from the large mountain of pharmaceutical industry cash that now overshadows the U.S. Congress. And so we have to understand the reconciliation bill as a battle between big money interests and what the public wants. And that if you go through each individual thing that's being taken out of this bill, they happen to have one thing or two things in common. One, they are the things that would ask corporate America and the wealthy to sacrifice just a bit. And they are also the things that the industries bankrolling the lawmakers writing the bill, that those industries are lobbying against.
Now, it would be very easy when Bernie Sanders was on CNN and talked about all the money that Big Pharma is spending. It would have been very easy for Dana Bash to say, all right, let's look at the list. Open Secrets has it. You know, let's look at the CEO pay, their profits. They don't do that. And if you watch these shows, every other ad is a drug. So, David, based on the research you've done, is one of the reasons why? Because cable and corporate media are getting so much money from Big Pharma?
Well, look, we did a big story at the Daily Poster looking at the news ecosystem. And I think you can trace corporate influence on the news ecosystem to the bottom of the corporate media pyramid. There are a series of Washington newsletters, Washington-focused publications that set the tone of the discourse. They do a lot of policing of the parameters of the debate. And it's become a lot more explicit in recent years that if you read, there's a Politico or Axios or Punchbowl News, not to pick on these, but they're exemplary of this issue. They will say at the top of their newsletters, presented by Exxon, presented by Chevron, presented by HCA, the healthcare giant. And what these publications tend to do is to defend the corporate politicians who are, in this case, slashing this bill, trying to whittle down this bill on behalf of their corporate donors, and marginalize the progressive lawmakers who are trying to fight for policies that are not only needed, but are supported by the vast majority of the country. And what ends up happening is that there's this constant thrum of Washington noise from these kinds of outlets that are bankrolled and sponsored by the industries and corporations lobbying for specific things. And this noise creates kind of the parameters of the discourse that what is considered. I mean, think about it. The people who are opposing the drug pricing bill that is supported by 90% of the country, they are portrayed. You see them often referred to in media as the quote moderates, the quote centrists. That Orwellian language is designed to marginalize the majority of the public, because, of course, those folks are not in the center of mainstream public opinion. So that's a long way of answering your question. The short answer is, I don't think that people in CNN's newsroom or the New York Times newsroom are taking orders directly from corporate sponsors. However, I also think the media industry knows who it works for. They know who pays the bills. And they are in a bubble of a hermetically sealed discourse bubble where most of the discourse is portraying what people want as fringe, what corporations want as centrist, and the politicians who are shilling for those corporations as the pragmatists.
You have a really important piece, just to stick with lower drug prices, by Walker Bragman and Julia Rock. Javier Becerra, who is the former Attorney General of California, who is now the Joe Biden's Health and Human Services Secretary, has the power to lower drug prices. So why isn't he? Tell us more about this.
Sure. Javier Becerra has been a longtime proponent of using what's called march-in rights. March-in rights is a provision that's been on the books for decades, which essentially allows a White House, an executive branch, to say that a set of government-sponsored drugs that the government paid to help research and develop, that the government, after giving away that research to the pharmaceutical industry, if those drugs are being sold on predatory prices, and of course they are in the United States, we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, that the government can march in, take those exclusive patent licenses that the government helped create and has been enforcing, and they can give it to a generic drug company and say, hey, this generic drug company can now produce the same drug at a fraction of the cost. So Biden has that power. Joe Biden has refused to use that power. And the person who is specifically in the Biden administration who has so far refused to use that power is Javier Becerra, who has been a proponent of that. In Congress, he signed on to letters demanding the Trump administration use that power. As Attorney General, about a year ago, he petitioned the federal government to allow to use this power. So he is now in the position, singularly, the HHS secretary is vested with this power. He could do this on the highest priced drugs right now, and he has not done that. So, of course, the question then becomes, well, why hasn't he done that? Well, guess who doesn't want that to be done? Certainly the American public wants that to be done. The industry that doesn't want it to be done just so happens to be one of the most politically powerful industries in the country, the pharmaceutical industry.
We're speaking with David Sirota, who is the founder of The Daily Poster. You can find his pieces and The Daily Poster at yourcallradio.org. We're going to stick with this for about 15 more minutes. If you have any questions or comments about the Democrats' social spending and climate bill, we'd love to hear from you. We've been talking about this for months. After so many negotiations, Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are still standing in the way. What questions do you have? 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. David, we also know that about a handful of House Democrats, as you say, have taken money from Big Pharma and do not want the government to negotiate drug prices. Now, the one thing I've been wondering in the last month or so, and I'm guessing you'll have the answer, are there other Democrats who also oppose aspects of the bill who do not want to publicly say that they oppose it and they'd rather just have Manchin and Sinema stand in the way?
Oh, I certainly think there's plenty of evidence for that. One piece of evidence that came out about that was that Bob Menendez, the senator from New Jersey, has suddenly had a huge amount of off-election year money from the pharmaceutical industry flooded into his campaign. This is about four or five months ago. And he suddenly came out and said that he has problems with this particular provision. So that was a signal that essentially Manchin and Sinema are blocking and tackling for some undefined number of other folks in the Congress who probably want this to go away, but don't want to take the public hit for making it go away. Now, to get back to decontextualizing for a second, because there's a California connection here beyond Javier Becerra. I mean, there is a congressman, Scott Peters, from the San Diego area, which I know is not near San Francisco, but it is in California. And this is a perfect example of what we're talking about. Scott Peters is cast was one of three Democrats in the House to cast a vote initially against this provision, the allowing Medicare to negotiate lower drug prices. He was one of three Democrats to try to block that in the House. He has now been anointed the lead negotiator for some sort of compromise measure. I put that in quotes because what they're trying to do is water it down. And almost all of the coverage mentions his lead role in this without mentioning that Scott Peters is quite literally the number one recipient of pharmaceutical campaign cash from the in the entire U.S. House of Representatives in the last election cycle and in this election cycle. So there is just it's just stripped out of the coverage. And I always wonder, doing follow the money reporting, how can you report on somebody like that? How can you report on his legislative actions on pharmaceutical issues without mentioning what is the single most germane fact of what people in the public need to know about this?
Well, and I've been wondering, given that Joe Manchin is swarmed by reporters on a regular basis, why, and maybe they have and it hasn't gotten out. Do you know if any reporter has asked Manchin to comment on what that Exxon lobbyist Keith McCoy said? Well, first let's play the clip just to remind everyone because so much is going on. So Exxon lobbyist Keith McCoy thought he was having a job interview, but he was actually being recorded by Greenpeace. And here is Keith McCoy, who no longer works for Exxon, bragging about having access to Democrats.
This is Keith McCoy, one of ExxonMobil's top Capitol Hill lobbyists.
Joe Manchin, I talk to his office every week, and he is the kingmaker on this because he's a Democrat from West Virginia, which is a very conservative state, and he's not shy about sort of staking his claim early and completely changing the debate. So on the Democrat side, we look for the moderates on these issues. So it's the Manchins, it's the Sinemas, it's the Testers.
Exxon is even trying to get through to President Biden through his friend, Senator Chris Coons.
Other ones that aren't talked about is Senator Coons, who's from Delaware, who has a very close relationship with Senator Biden. So we've been working with his office. Matter of fact, our CEO is talking to him next Tuesday. Then you take it out a little bit more and you say, okay, well, who's up for re-election in 2022? That's Hassan, that's Kelly. And then obviously the Republicans. We have a great relationship with the senators where we have assets. I can't worry about the 2027 class because they're not focused on re-election. The 2022 class is focused on re-election. So I know I have them. Those are the Marco Rubios. Those are the Senator Kennedys. Those are the Senator Daines. So you can have those conversations with them because they're a captive audience. They know they need you and I need them. We're playing defense because President Biden's talking about this big infrastructure package. Why would you put in something on emissions reductions on climate change to oil refineries in a highway bill?
Mr. McCoy then told us how Exxon aggressively fought to discredit climate science. He also told us how, even now, talking down solutions to global warming, like renewable energy and electric vehicles, is critically important to the work Exxon does in Washington, D.C.
Did we aggressively fight against some of the science? Yes. Did we join some of these shadow groups to work against some of the early efforts? Yes, that's true. But there's nothing illegal about that.
That is Exxon lobbyist Keith McCoy thinking that he was taking part in a job interview, but he was actually talking to Greenpeace. He no longer works at Exxon. Thanks to Democracy Now! For that clip. We're speaking with David Sirota, who's founder of the Daily Poster. David, given that so many reporters are swarming Manchin, have any of them asked him about what Exxon says?
I haven't seen that, and it may have happened. I'm not sure, but I can tell you this. He was asked about his own family ties to the coal industry, belatedly, by the way. This has been reported by outlets like The Intercept for months, that Joe Manchin makes, I think, the majority of his annual earnings have been from his family's coal related business. And he only recently was asked about this. And he basically said, you don't want to be asking about that. He made it out to be completely impolite. He actually seemed to be pretty ticked off that anyone dared to ask him about it. And the point in the exchange, the takeaway from that is that these legislators are so not used to even being politely questioned about these things. It's just not part of what happens in Washington, even though that, of course, it is determinative of what they're doing in Washington. I mean, you cannot, the only way Washington and what it's doing is confusing, is mystifying, is bizarre, is if you are averting your eyes from that river of corporate campaign cash flooding into the system to buy votes. That, like that, if you can't bring that into your mind, then yeah, politics doesn't make any sense. But guess what? It makes perfect sense if you simply follow the money first and realize that what you're seeing is typically an expression of what that money wants.
Right. And we have an email about the Republican side. I mean, no Republican supports this bill at all. And Chris says, what are their ties to Big Pharma?
Oh, the Republicans have enormous ties to the pharmaceutical industry. And look, I think it's wrong to write the Republicans out of what's going on in Washington in the sense that they are very clearly a party that explicitly represents big money corporate interests. They are not serious about dealing with any of these problems. I think the Democrats are the ones who control the government. They're the ones who are saying they're doing things. And look, this relates to the podcast series that I just completed with Alex Gibney, the director, which is to say that in 2009 and 2010, the Democrats came into office promising, making clear promises to help people in the middle of an economic crisis. And they subsequently went to bat for their Wall Street donors. They did not deliver real help in a significant way to millions of people. The foreclosure crisis happened. The bailout was a top-down bailout. It was not redirected into helping lots of homeowners. And guess what? Lots of voters got disillusioned, and the Democrats got shellacked in the midterm election in 2010. And the reason that's germane now is because every time you see the Democrats paring back their promised agenda in order to protect their campaign donors, they are running the risk of repeating that precise history. And it really connects to the democracy crisis. I think this hasn't been talked about enough, that whether or not you're delivering on economics connects innately to the crisis of democracy in this way. If you keep getting elected promising to deliver help, and then you get into power and you don't deliver help and you protect your corporate donors instead, then come the next election, when you say you have to elect us to protect democracy, lots of voters are going to say, I just used democracy to put you into power based on the promises that you made and you didn't deliver. And so why should I care about democracy? So those crises, the economic crisis and the democracy crisis, are connected.
Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Thanks for holding.
Hello. I hope your guests can try to explain this to me. I'm wondering why the House just can't get a bill passed, send it to the Senate, and let Manchin and Sinema, if they need to or want to, vote against it, and then see what happens at that point. The problem I've got, as long as this goes on, is that Manchin and Sinema are perfectly willing to see harm done to huge portions of the American public, and also to undermine the Democrats' chances of retaining the House and the Senate and the presidency in these upcoming elections, which would be a disaster. So I think what's happening, at least when I watch this, it looks like a dog and pony show at this point. And I think the Republicans are just sitting back watching the Democrats self-destruct. And I'm not clear about why they just don't act, get this to the Senate, and see what the Senate does, and then go from there.
It's a great question, and it's something that we've written a lot about at the Daily Poster, which is this. We did an article called Call Their Bluff, which is essentially what the caller is talking about. Stop cutting apart a good bill, pass a good bill through the House, and then make Manchin and Sinema try to strip out the things that they don't like. They'd have to, if this process took place, they would have to offer an amendment on the floor of the Senate saying, take out the paid leave, take out the drug pricing provisions. They don't want to be on the spot, the two of them. They are getting exactly what they want. They get to stand back, make comments in the press, get the Democratic leaders to negotiate down the bill without themselves, Manchin and Sinema, having to take really the heat for it, having to actually stand on the floor of the Senate and do it. And the Democrats, I would argue, have not done this because a certain part of their party does not want to do it. That in the terms of poker, that's the tell that they say they're fighting, but they're not willing to do that simple process that the caller just laid out. And so that is really, that tells you whether they're willing to fight. And the last thing I'll say on that is that it evokes that famous quote from Paul Wellstone. And I'm going to butcher it here because I can't remember it exactly, but the paraphrase of it is basically, if we tell people we're fighting for things and then we don't stand up and fight for those things, then it suggests we're not actually for those things. Now, certainly some Democrats are for those things, but the fact that that process has not taken place is an indictment of whether the party as a whole really truly does believe in those things rather than just wanting to talk about those things without delivering on them.
So where are we now, David? It's November 2nd. What is the time frame here? What do we expect to happen in the coming week or two?
Well, Biden is saying he wants a bill yesterday. Now there's talk that the Democrats, that the progressives are going to allow this bipartisan infrastructure bill to pass first, which a lot of folks are very concerned about because the progressives have said, listen, we got to keep the bipartisan infrastructure bill connected to the human infrastructure bill, this reconciliation bill we're talking about, in order to compel Manchin, Sinema, and conservative Democrats to vote for the human infrastructure bill. Because if we pass the bipartisan bill first, then there's no pressure on the conservative Democrats to actually support the things that the public really wants. So potentially passing the bipartisan bill first arguably makes it even harder to pass the human infrastructure bill, the bill with the healthcare stuff, the paid leave, it doesn't have paid leave anymore, but you get the point. So it's anyone's guess what's going on here. There's definitely a game of chicken going on. Manchin is expecting the House progressives to simply roll over and just play dead. The House progressives are starting to signal that that's exactly what they might do. And look, Biden is just looking for a deal. And that's partially the most dangerous political part of this, that if they gut the reconciliation bill and they pass a bill just to say, hey, look, we passed something, they're going to go out and try to sell that, a gutted bill, as some great victory for the public. And the risk of that is if it doesn't actually deliver a lot of real help to people, then people are not only going to be hurting, they're going to be saying, you're saying you help me, and I don't feel the help you say you're getting to me. And that's going to be the feeling on the eve of the midterm election. So that comes back to the final point. In my view, the best way to try to win a midterm election is to deliver as much direct and immediate help to people as possible. And every time you capitulate and surrender a piece of help to the public, you, the Democratic Party, are making it harder to get reelected in the midterm elections.
And so it's incredible to think that 80% of the population, I mean, here's a Washington Post headline. Most Americans want Congress to support child care and elder care, even many Republicans. Well, of course, any Republican who's on Medicare is going to greatly benefit from expanding it. I mean, unfortunately, dental and vision did not make it, but hearing aids did. And, you know, Bernie is working his tail off trying to change that. But obviously, Republicans will benefit from all of this. I mean, it's amazing to think, David, that the pundit class is already on 2022 saying if the Dems don't get this, the Republicans are going to crush the Democrats, a Republican Party that supports none of this.
And it's even more Orwellian. There's this narrative in the press that's the Democrats have to pare back their reconciliation bill to appeal to so-called moderate voters in order to try to win the election. When again, very recent history tells us the exact opposite lesson. The lesson from 2009 and 2010, which we took 2 years to report out in this new podcast at Audible called Meltdown. The lesson is, if you pare back your promised agenda to defend your corporate donors, you raise the risk that you will get destroyed in a midterm election. That is the lesson of the 2009-2010 experience. And the fact that the media has helped create the idea now that the opposite is true, it's incredibly Orwellian, because history is screaming at us. And by the way, distant history is screaming at us. The other flip side of that history is what FDR did. Not that his presidency was perfect, but he came into office amid a crisis. And there are many quotes from him explicitly saying that we have to pass a new deal to invest in the working class quickly and directly, not only because that's the moral thing to do, not only because that's the economically necessary thing to do, but because that's the best chance we have to fight off the rise of fascism in the United States, which was on the rise back then. That he understood that delivering for the working class was a way to halt the cogent arguments of fascists who were trying to take advantage of the economic pain that was out there. So the point is that if you update it to now, you've got right-wing insurrectionists, you've got anti-democracy Republicans on the march right now, arguing to the working class of this country that the Democrats refuse to deliver for them. The best way to combat that rise of right-wing authoritarianism in the country is to actually do everything you can to deliver for the public as quickly as you can. And every time you pare that back, you are helping the authoritarians who want to take over the government in the midterms and in the next presidential election.
David Sirota is founder of The Daily Poster, a reader-supported investigative journalism project, and host of the new podcast Meltdown, which explores the 2008 financial crisis. David, thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back to talk more about Meltdown.
Thank you. Anytime. Happy to do it. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, and happy birthday. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the after effects of the anti-abortion bill in Texas. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard arguments from Texas attorneys, the Biden administration, and abortion providers. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.